This is University Forum. I'm Jean Moore, bringing you conversations with outstanding personalities on issues of interest to local, national, and international communities. Our conversation today is part one of a two-part conversation focusing on Sundown Towns, a Hidden Dimension of Racism in America. My guest, by telephone to Washington, D.C., is its nationally known author, Dr. James Loewen, a distinguished lecturer of the Organization of American Historians, a member of the American Historical Association and the American Sociological Association, a professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Vermont, where he taught race relations for 20 years. Dr. Loewen's also taught at Tougaloo College in Mississippi. Welcome to University Forum, Dr. Loewen.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Well, it's my pleasure to have you on the program because this particular topic, which involves access to housing and areas of one's choice, is very close to my heart. And many communities, even today, are devoid of people of color. And you have unearthed really a very dark set of secrets that most individuals and communities, they try to continue to deny. Would you please start out by explaining what a sundown town is or was?
Sure.
As you've bluntly said in the beginning of the opening of your book.
Sure. A sundown town is a town that was for decades, and as you mentioned, some of them still are, that was for decades all white on purpose. And the title is not known much in Pennsylvania or in the Northeast. But the concept is very common. There's plenty of all-white towns in Pennsylvania and in New York and so on that were all-white on purpose. The term sundown town comes from the fact that many of these towns in the Midwest, in Oregon, in California, in the Plains, had signs at their city limits. And these signs typically said, quote, "Nigger, don't let the sun go down on you" in Manitowoc, for instance, which was the sign that was at the edge of Manitowoc, Wisconsin. And that's how they got the term, sundown towns.
And that's the way it started as far as the signs being up there. But what actually did it involve? I mean, when and how did these towns use that overt message?
Well, they don't go back forever. They weren't always this way, most of them. Sundown towns are a creation of the period 1890 to 1940. And this is the period that historians are increasingly coming to call the nadir of race relations. That's, of course, N-A-D-I-R, we're not talking mouth, meaning low point of race relations. And the reason that it's considered the nadir of race relations is, well, three things happened that caused us to date it in 1890. First, there was the massacre at Wounded Knee, which ended the last shards of independent Indian sovereignty in America. And so they entered a nadir for sure. And then there was the Mississippi State Constitution of 1890, which removed blacks from citizenship, took away the vote, and was a direct defiance of the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution passed during Reconstruction. But the United States did nothing. And finally, there was the failure by a single vote in the United States Senate to pass the Fair Elections Act. Now, this had passed the House, and if it had passed the Senate, Republican President Benjamin Harrison would certainly have signed it into law. We have to remember that the Republicans were the good guys on race relations in the 19th century. The Democrats called themselves the white man's party and were the party of white supremacy. And when they defeated this bill, they did what they usually did. They attempted to tag the Republicans as, quote, black Republicans, unquote. You folks ain't nothing but a bunch of, quote, nigger lovers, and so on. And the Republicans had weathered these storms in the past. They had replied, well, you're darn right, and somebody has to stand up for these people. What you're doing down in the South is wrong. But this time, they made a new reply. No, we aren't, they said. And at that point, 1891, they gave up on the cause of race relations and civil rights for all. And so that's why we say that the nation plunged into the abyss of the nadir of race relations, 1890 to 1940. And we really, I think, became more racist in terms of our ideology, even than during slavery times. Because I think during slavery times, there's always the sneaking feeling, well, the reason these black folks are enslaved has something to do with the fact that West African communities were weaker militarily than the British, than the Portuguese, than the United States, for that matter. And so there was kind of a military conquest involved. But between 1890 and 1940, whites tried to ask and answer this question. Well, how come African Americans are still poorer than anybody else in our society, except maybe Native Americans who really weren't in our society? And they concluded, well, it has to be their own darn fault. And so this is the rise of so-called scientific racism and eugenics, and it's also the rise of sundown towns.
Was there also some discussion at that time as to how much blacks were getting and doing? They were, during the certainly Reconstruction era, involved in some of the politics and were perhaps getting a little bit more than they perhaps were deserved, according to the perception of some.
Well, certainly white Democratic Southerners, and that was a majority of white Southerners, although it wasn't all white Southerners by any means, but certainly white Democrats in the South thought black folks were acting uppity and thought they were far too powerful. And so between 1890, when Mississippi did it, and 1907, when Oklahoma did it, every single southern state and every border state, and even new states like Oklahoma, proceeded to copy Mississippi and disfranchise blacks and remove them from citizenship. I think this was largely just playing a power grab by the Democrats. And the Republicans kind of didn't know what to do about it, and what they ended up doing about it was to try to win white votes, which they pretty much failed at, of course, until the two parties flip-flopped on race way up here in 1964. And so, for you know, we have the term the Solid South, which really comes about after 1890 and during this nadir period.
Now, when this was happening, though, in the low points, as we call the nadir,
yes.
What manifestation besides the signs that went up? I mean, that's a sign.
Oh, yeah.
What happened?
Sure. A lot of people don't really understand this. For instance, people think that the first black ball player in the baseball's major leagues was Jackie Robinson. Well, this is not true. Black folks were in the major leagues. The last one got thrown out in 1889, just as the nadir was setting in. So Jackie Robinson is the first black ball player in the major leagues in the 20th century, or after the nadir, because he, of course, came in 1947. Similarly, black folks, black jockeys, won more than half of all of the Kentucky Derbies, up through the 31st running of it, which was in 1913, I believe. And then in that year, they were outlawed, and they haven't won a single Kentucky Derby since. Isn't that amazing? More important than these sports, although these are very important symbolically, but more important than these sports positions, African-Americans had all kinds of jobs in 1890. They were postmen, for instance. They were carpenters. They were skilled laborers, and so on. But between 1890 and 1940, they get removed from these jobs. The Wilson administration, Woodrow Wilson, which was in power from 1913 to 1921, segregated the post office. And this amounted to, in many places, removal of blacks as mail sorters or postal carriers. And lynchings went to their all-time high. And, of course, we know the infamous Supreme Court decision, Plessy versus Ferguson, and a host of other Supreme Court decisions after that 1896 decision, all of them happening during the nadir. It was really, flatly, a terrible time to be black or to be Native American in the United States, North as well as South.
You also mentioned the Chinese in your book.
Yes.
What was happening in that era?
Yeah, the Chinese Americans in the West have kind of the same problem that African Americans had, and they actually had it first. I originally thought that the reason Chinese folks, Chinese Americans, were and even are concentrated in San Francisco Chinatown and Chicago Chinatown and New York City Chinatown is because they left from a big city, after all. I mean, ocean ships leave from big cities, in this case Canton, China, and they came into a big city, San Francisco, then the largest city in the West. So just naturally, they wound up in these big cities. This is not true. Between 1848, when they first started coming into the United States in large numbers, and about 1880, Chinese went everywhere. They were in every county in Wyoming. They were 20% of the population of Idaho, one of our most rural western states. They were all over the place, in little towns, even out in the rural, tanning gold and fishing and gardening and doing all kinds of things. But then, between about 1884 and 1900, they commenced what I call the Chinese retreat. And they are forced out of every county in Wyoming except one. They're forced out of many, many towns and counties in Idaho. They're forced out of more than 50 towns in California. Even large cities like Tacoma, Washington, force their entire Chinese population out, send them on two big boats to San Francisco. And that's how they wound up so concentrated in big cities. And basically, that's kind of a prologue, if you will, for what then happened to African Americans.
Now, when you say they were forced out, some would say, well, if they didn't want to go, why did they leave?
Because people aimed guns at them. People literally forced them onto boxcars. I have a picture in my book, Sundown Towns. I think it's the second picture in the book of Chinese being forced onto boxcars in a town, actually a whole county, in Northern California. And they're going to be shipped then down the rail line down to San Francisco.
So nobody went voluntarily on this. They were just completely, as you use the term, expelled.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, a race riot in one of the first expulsions was from Rock Springs, Wyoming. And in that expulsion, at least 200 Chinese were killed. And the entire Chinatown was burned, with some people still alive in the houses and in the basements of the houses who were then engulfed in flames.
It sounds like a prologue to what happened for quite a few years during that period to the African Americans,
yeah,
as far as the burnout.
I call that the Great Retreat. And one of the things that's amazing about my book, and I'm not bragging, and in fact I'm actually complaining, is that there's never been a book on this subject before. This is the first book on Sundown Towns, and I'm actually the first scholar to notice the Great Retreat. And what happened was, just like Chinese Americans, after the Civil War, in fact, really before it even ended, as early as 1863, African Americans went everywhere in America. They wound up in every county in Montana, for instance, save one. They wound up in every county in Indiana, except one. That was between 1863 and 1890. But then, in 1890, this nadir of race relations sets in, and they get driven out of town after town, and even whole counties, county after county. And Indiana winds up with probably 23 counties or so that were sundown counties. The entire county, or almost most parts of the county, did not allow blacks to live in them. Blacks get driven out of towns in Wisconsin, in the state of Washington, in Oregon, all kinds of places where you wouldn't, well, I didn't think at first that they would have been there. My original thought was, well, why do black folks have to go everywhere? Why do they have to go to every little town? You know, I thought that my largest category of all-white towns would be towns that were all-white by accident, where no black person ever happened to go. But during my research, I actually realized that I was misthinking it. Can I tell you an aha moment I had when this realization hit?
Yes, do.
I was speaking in October of 2001. In Decatur, Illinois. Now, that's my hometown, actually. It's an industrial city right in the middle of Illinois. And the success of my book, Lies, my teacher told me, had prompted them to invite me to be the headline speaker for the second biennial Decatur Writers Conference. Okay, great. I gave a talk at the Decatur Public Library on the subject of Lies, my teacher told me. And at the end of my talk, I mentioned to the audience about my new book, that I was working on, it wasn't a book then, called Sundown Towns, and I explained what they were, and if anybody knew anything about them, would they please come down afterwards? To my amazement, 20 people came down, and they told me about every little town around Decatur. Now, growing up in Decatur as a kid, I was aware that these little towns like Niantic and Monticello and Pena and so on were all white. But it never occurred to me that they were all white on purpose. I mean, I didn't want to live in Niantic, population 900, you know. I wanted to live in a town that had a motion picture theater and so on. So I figured, well, probably black folks did too. But this turned out not to be the case. I mean, for instance, two people told me that they understood that Niantic, which is a little town that actually adjoins Decatur on the northwest side, that Niantic had passed an ordinance to the effect that black folks were not allowed after dark, and that as a result, that work trains on the Wabash Railroad. Now, the Wabash was the biggest railroad in town. They have a huge yard there. It's now part of the Norfolk Southern. And every night, the work train on the Wabash Railroad had to move from the Niantic part of the yard into the Decatur part of the yard to avoid offending this ordinance because, of course, people sleep on the work train, and some of those people, some of those track workers, were black. So they had to move the whole train, and I later confirmed that with two former employees of the Wabash.
You are listening to University Forum with my guest, author and sociologist, Dr. James Loewen, we are discussing his new book, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of Racism in America. Continue with some examples of how these expulsions, how violent they were, what happened as you move
along.
Well,
in many cases, see, as far as I know, Niantic passed an ordinance and didn't have any African Americans at the time that they passed it. Now, I haven't really checked that out. They may have. But many, many other towns, I mentioned Pena, for instance. Pena is a city, really, of about 5,000 people, 30 miles south of Decatur in central Illinois. And I found out that in 1899, Pena had a race riot. This was, of course, whites rioting against blacks.
Yes, do make that distinction. People don't understand when you say race riot, which way it went.
Every race riot in American history up until 1942 was, in fact, whites rioting against people of color, either against blacks or against Chinese Americans or other people of color. And Pena is no exception. And in 1899, there was a coal strike in Pena. And management, in its infinite wisdom, brought in some black strikebreakers from the South. I think they were from Kentucky and northern Alabama. And, of course, white coal miners had a legitimate grievance against the strikebreakers, which was compounded then with the racial difference. And they eventually drove out the entire black population of Pena, not just the strikebreakers, but all of them, with one exception that I'll mention in a minute. And so that was in 1899, and they proceeded to put up the notorious Sundown Town signs at the north, south, east, and west highways coming into Pena. Now, I mentioned the exception. They didn't drive out the barber. They had nothing against the barber. The barber had a white clientele. He was well-liked by his customers. So they left the barber alone. There's no doubt that Pena became a Sundown Town. After all, they put up the signs. In fact, later, Pena became so racist that it became almost what we might call a daytime town as well. That is to say, I came to learn that in as late as the 1960s and the early 1970s, African-American motorists could not even buy gas in Pena. Now, this just astounded me. I mean, I lived in Mississippi for 8 years, and I never heard of a single gas station in Mississippi that refused to sell gas to a black customer. Some of them weren't nice about it, and some of them didn't have any restrooms that black folks could use, but it would never occur to them not to sell gas and make a profit after all. And if you think about it, it even sounds counterproductive. I mean, here you have a town that's trying to be a sundown town and trying to keep blacks out, and you have a black family that needs some gas to get out of town, and they won't sell you any.
You gave an example in your book of one case in which they didn't just let them out and let them go peaceably, but were also helping them a little bit with some firearms and shooting after them.
Oh, yeah. There are certainly many, many, well, and what happened, in fact, in Pena in 1899 was they actually killed five black strikebreakers and, as I say, drove the entire black population out. Now, what I've actually discovered in writing this book, Sundown Towns, is somewhere upwards of 40 towns that had little mini race riots like Pena that drove out their black populations. And up until now, these race riots have been lost to history. I mean, we know about the ones in big cities like East St. Louis in 1917 and Chicago in 1919, Tulsa in 1921. But it turns out there was a race riot against blacks in Pinckneyville, Illinois. I'm not even sure what date. I think 1928. And you can have the eerie experience, and I did have this experience, of walking in Pinckneyville through the former black neighborhood, which is now called the Black Hills. And trust me, it doesn't look like South Dakota. By Black Hills, they're, of course, referring to its former racial makeup, even though it stopped being black in 1928, which is, what, almost 80 years ago. And you can see things like the former black school, which is now a white-owned house. And
well,
I don't actually know if these black residents got any payment at all when they fled their houses and fled Pinckneyville, but I can certainly tell you they didn't get a fair payment because it was certainly a distress sale.
Well, is this not the case in so many instances? And you've mentioned a number of towns, and I think I mentioned to you the town of Elaine, Arkansas.
Well,
it turned out to be a mammoth kind. There's been a new documentary completed on that, if you're not yet aware of it, and I hope that you get a chance to see it, in which it sounded as though there were quite a few more, if that was not almost as or probably worse than Tulsa.
Oh, yeah. Elaine, I think a whole bunch of African-Americans were killed in Elaine. It's hard to know because many of them were rural and the record-keeping wasn't too good, and, of course, they didn't want to keep good records on this. But I don't include Elaine for the simple reason that Elaine is in northeastern Arkansas in the plantation area. It's really the Arkansas side of what's called the Mississippi Delta. And the murders there were in the interest of keeping African Americans down rather than driving them out. But the race riots I'm talking about, since I'm limiting myself to sundown towns, were for the purpose of driving them out. And there were at least two or three other such riots, such drive-outs in Arkansas, probably more like a couple of dozen others, but Harrison, Arkansas, for instance, drove out its black population in two different race riots. I think it was 1905 and 1909. They didn't get them all in the first riot, and so they had another riot in 1909. And Harrison was all white and a sundown town until, well, they may still be, but I think they kind of apologized for it about 2 years ago, and I think Harrison now has a black resident or two.
What's been the role during this time of the federal government or the state government, and, of course, the counter role of the Ku Klux Klan?
Well, the federal government, unfortunately, has played, well, played up until 1968, an absolutely negative role. And this is interesting because way back in 1917, there was a Supreme Court decision on this matter that was actually positive. It's one of the few Supreme Court decisions on race during the Nader that wasn't just one more racist decision. And this case, called Buchanan versus Worley, was about segregation ordinances, residential segregation ordinances. Large southern cities and nearby cities like as far north as Baltimore and St. Louis and Louisville, New Orleans and so on, passed these segregation ordinances. There was kind of a wave of them between about 1914 and 1918 or so. And what they said was, okay, every block in a city ought to be all black or all white. I mean, they were really favoring total apartheid. And they said, if we have an interracial block and it's majority black, then it is illegal for any white person to buy or rent a house on that block, except for the ones who are already there. And if we have a block that's majority white, or all white for that matter, of course, then it's illegal for a black person to buy or rent a house or a residence on that block, except for the ones already there. Well, now, of course, all the ones already there are eventually going to move or die, and so that would eliminate all interracial blocks. Well, the ordinance sounded equal-handed in that it applied to both whites in black blocks and blacks in white blocks. In fact, it was only enforced against blacks trying to move into white blocks. And the NAACP finally took it to court in 1917, one of their earliest victories. And they won, and the reason they won, actually, was because the court realized that a white right was being trampled on. And it worked like this. Let's suppose that your house, let's say you are white, and your house is worth $100,000, and it's in a white neighborhood. And you can sell it to some white person because you want to sell it for $100,000. But some black person wants to buy it for $110,000. Maybe they want to get out of the ghetto. Maybe the ghetto's crowded. Maybe for whatever reason, they want to live in the neighborhood, and they want to pay you $110,000. Well, you can't sell it to them because of this ordinance. Therefore, you are getting screwed out of $10,000. So that right, the right to dispose of your property the way you wish and to the highest bidder, is being infringed upon by this law. So the ordinances were found unconstitutional. Didn't make any difference to sundown towns. It did stop these ordinances in the South. But meanwhile, northern cities passed flatly racist ordinances that just said blacks are not allowed to rent or buy houses in this town. Or sometimes they said blacks are not allowed to be in this town after dark. And nothing was done about it. And this taught me that ordinances are not, or laws, like Supreme Court decisions, are not self-enforcing. The federal government didn't even enforce the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Rather, black folks enforce them, in a sense. And what I mean by that is if an African-American goes to a restaurant in 1965 after the 64 Civil Rights Act and doesn't get served, then he or she can complain about it to the Justice Department, can file a complaint with the FBI, and the FBI, in many cases, will actually then, at the least, and sometimes at the most, go interview the owner of the restaurant or the motel, And that's a little bit chilling, you know, and that causes people to say, oh, maybe I can't get away with this. Maybe I better serve them next time. But it requires the black complaint. In a sundown town, there often was no complaint because there's no black folks there. So the federal government did nothing. And even worse than that, repeatedly during the FDR administration, the federal government set up all-white towns. It actually created at least 7 different all-white towns during the FDR administration. One of them is near me. It's called Greenbelt, Maryland, and it's supposed to be an ideal suburb. It was supposed to provide work during the Depression, but also provide us all, provide Americans with a model of an ideal community. And it's very interesting in its layout and very interesting in its architecture. And, of course, this ideal community would be all white, wouldn't it? I mean, isn't that what we mean by ideal? So the federal government just itself completely flouted the decision in 1917.
And I know we want to talk a little bit more about what the federal government did with its FHA policies.
Yep,
and
we have
all
to
that.
Move to the FHA.
Yeah. I don't know if we'll get to all of that before we have our second conversation, but as we close down, begin to think of closing down this part of it, what do you see as the rationale behind keeping the towns all white, not only then, but even now?
Well, I think that we were in such a racist mindset, and by we I mean white folks, but I also mean in a sense the whole country, not of course African Americans or Native Americans, but we were in such a racist mindset between 1890 and 1940 that black folks were simply defined as a negative, an evil, maybe certainly stupider people, people you don't want to be around, and so on. Well, if they're inferior, if that's why they're poor, they're just flatly inferior and they shouldn't have rights, well then why do we let them in our town? And I think there actually became, in the North, a contagion of kind of almost good government acts. I mean, you haven't driven yours out already? We drove ours out. Why haven't you driven yours out? And so the next town over says, oh, yeah, that is a good idea. Or you haven't passed an ordinance requiring blacks not to be in town? Well, that is a good idea. And so I think these ordinances swept through, and I think these little race riots swept through town after town in the Midwest, in Oregon, and so on.
And what you clarify is that this was not a Southern phenomenon.
That's right. Everybody thinks. When I've been telling people what I'm studying, they all say to me, oh, yeah, down in Mississippi, down in Alabama. No. Now, I lived in Mississippi for years, and so I made a great effort to try to locate every sundown town I could find in Mississippi. I found 6, I believe. But in Illinois, I found 472. Now, that's an actual majority of all incorporated towns in the state of Illinois. Compare 472 in Illinois to 6 in Mississippi. The South didn't do it. In fact, white Southerners were amazed at it. Why would you drive out your maid? Why would you drive out your agricultural labor force? It never occurred to them. I mean, they did plenty of racist things. But the traditional South, at least, never did sundown towns. Now, I do have to say,
I think what we might call the non-traditional South did, that is
like Appalachia and the Ozarks.
And we'll have to continue this conversation for our next University Forum program, picking up on the relatively recent time frame as well and the role of the FHA policies and the impact of the white noose around the cities. And I want to thank you so much for being with me for this first part, Dr. Lowen, an eminent sociologist and prolific researcher and author.
I'll look forward to the second half.
I'm Jean Moore. Please send your comments or questions on University Forum programs to me by email at jemoore@wrti.org or call my voicemail 215-204-4376.